A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us a question that seems simple on its face. How many people around the world lack access to clean, safe drinking water? And is that number going down? But the most commonly cited figure, 2.2 billion people without safe water, comes from a 2019 WHO UNICEF report. That number is already stale, and the methodology behind it is surprisingly fragile. In March of this year, the UN released its mid-decade SDG 6 progress report, and the world is not on track. So we've got fresh data and some new controversies to dig into.
The first thing to understand, before we can even answer whether the number is decreasing, is what access to clean water actually means in official statistics. Because that's where everything gets slippery.
Of course it does. Define your terms, and the crisis either shrinks by a factor of three, or balloons into something unmeasurable.
The gold standard definition comes from the Joint Monitoring Program, the JMP, which is run by WHO and UNICEF. They use something called Indicator 6.1.1 under the Sustainable Development Goals. The metric is safely managed drinking water. That means three things. The water source has to be improved, so a protected well, a piped connection, a borehole. It has to be located on the premises. And it has to be available when needed and free from fecal and chemical contamination.
And the third one, the contamination piece, is where the whole thing starts to wobble.
Because the JMP doesn't just have a binary has water or doesn't. They use what's called the ladder framework. The bottom is surface water, rivers, lakes, irrigation ditches. Next is unimproved sources, unprotected wells, tanker trucks from sketchy vendors. Then limited service, which means an improved source, but it's more than a 30-minute round trip to fetch it. Then basic service, an improved source within 30 minutes. And at the top, safely managed. The headline number depends entirely on which rung of this ladder you call access.
When someone says 2.2 billion people lack access to clean water, they're using the top rung. That's the safely managed number. If you drop down one rung and ask who lacks even basic access, meaning improved water within 30 minutes, the number collapses to about 700 million.
And that's the core tension. The two numbers describe fundamentally different problems. The 703 million without basic access, those are people who need wells drilled, pipes laid, infrastructure built. The additional 1.5 billion who have basic access but not safely managed. They have a tap or a protected well, but the water might not be reliably safe, or it might be intermittent, or it's shared between multiple households. That's a contamination and reliability problem, not an infrastructure desert.
The crisis is simultaneously enormous, and also much narrower than the headline suggests, depending on what you're trying to solve for. It's like going to a doctor and saying, I'm sick, versus specifying whether you have a broken leg or a bacterial infection. Same word, completely different treatment plan.
That's a good way to frame it, and that brings us to the measurement problem. How does the JMP actually count these people? Because you might imagine there's some global sensor network, real-time water quality monitoring. There isn't. They use household surveys, the demographic and health surveys, DHS, the Multiple Indicator Cluster Surveys, MICS, and National Census Data. Surveys ask a question like, what is your main source of drinking water? And people self-report. They say, piped water or a borehole or the river. That's the proxy.
So it's the UNO system for water quality. And a borehole that tested clean 3 years ago, but has been slowly accumulating nitrates from nearby fertilizer runoff. That's still an improved source on paper.
That's exactly the blind spot, and it gets worse. The safely managed tier requires water to be free from fecal and chemical contamination, but most countries don't test water quality in their surveys. The WHO published a report in 2021 on water quality monitoring, and it found that only 45% of countries have national water quality testing programs. 45%. The rest use predictive models. They look at sanitation coverage, population density, and they estimate contamination risk statistically.
For more than half the world's countries, the safely managed designation is a modeled guess, not a measurement. That's like estimating how many people have malaria by looking at mosquito net distribution data and rainfall patterns, rather than actually testing blood samples. You might get close, but you're going to miss a lot.
Even where testing exists, it's usually at the source, not at the point of use. You test the borehole, it's clean. But the water gets carried home in a jerry can that hasn't been washed in 6 months, stored in an open container, dipped with a cup that also touched raw food. The contamination happens between the source and the mouth.
Which is why point-of-use testing often tells a much grimmer story. You mentioned Ethiopia.
Ethiopia's 2024 DHS survey showed 68% basic access. But a Stanford study in 2025 did EDIAS, coli testing at the point of use in people's homes, and found only 41% of sources were actually free of contamination at the point where someone drinks it. That's a 27-point gap between what the survey says and what the water actually contains.
27 points. That's not a margin of error. That's an entirely different reality.
This isn't unique to Ethiopia. It's the norm wherever water quality testing is sparse. The JMP itself acknowledges this. Their reports include a note that safely managed estimates for many countries are based on limited data and modeling assumptions. But that disclaimer doesn't make it into the headlines.
Of course it doesn't. 2.2 billion people lack safely managed water, but that number is partly modeled, and we're not totally sure, doesn't fit on a chyron. So let's talk about where the problem is actually concentrated. The urban versus rural split.
8 out of 10 people without even basic water access live in rural areas. But here's what's interesting. The gap is narrowing. Rural access grew from 71% to 81% between 2015 and 2024. That's real progress. Urban access, meanwhile, stagnated at 96%. The remaining challenge is increasingly in peri-urban areas and informal settlements.
That urban 96% number masks something.
Jakarta is the perfect case study. 60% of the city relies on unregulated groundwater. The municipal pipe system is classified as an improved source, so those households show up in the statistics as having access. But in many neighborhoods, that piped water is available for maybe 4 hours a day. People fill buckets when it flows and ration it. The groundwater they're pumping to fill the gap is causing the city to sink, literally, subsidence of up to 25 centimeters per year in some areas. And that groundwater is increasingly contaminated with saltwater intrusion and sewage.
The survey says improved access. The reality is 4 hours of unreliable flow, sinking land, and contaminated backup sources. This is the difference between a ticked box and actual water security. And it makes me wonder, how does the JMP framework even handle intermittency? If the tap exists, but it's dry most of the day, does that trigger any kind of downgrade?
It's supposed to, in theory. The available when needed criterion in the safely managed definition is meant to catch intermittency. But in practice, survey questions about reliability are notoriously vague. They ask things like, in the last 2 weeks, was there any time when you did not have sufficient water? People adapt their expectations downward. If you're used to water coming for 2 hours a day, and you've structured your whole life around filling containers during that window, you might answer, no, I had sufficient water because you got what you expected. The survey captures perceived adequacy, not objective reliability.
The metric is measuring satisfaction with an unacceptable baseline. It's the water equivalent of asking someone in a food desert if they had enough to eat. And they say yes because they're comparing themselves to a famine, not to a balanced diet.
And Jakarta isn't an outlier. It's a preview of what happens when cities grow faster than their water infrastructure. The JMP framework wasn't designed to capture intermittency well. If you have a piped connection, you're counted as improved, even if that pipe is dry for 20 hours a day.
Where's the worst of it?
Sub-Saharan Africa accounts for 60% of the global population without basic water access. That's the epicenter. But the country-level numbers are surprising. India alone has 163 million people without basic access. That's more than any country except Nigeria and Ethiopia combined. And India's numbers are improving rapidly, but the absolute scale is still staggering. China has effectively solved basic access, 99% plus. The challenge there has shifted to groundwater quality, arsenic, industrial contamination, nitrate pollution from agriculture. They've solved the is there a tap problem and are now dealing with the is what comes out of the tap safe problem. That's actually the direction the whole world is moving, just at different speeds.
The headline numbers are squishier than they look. But the more important question is the trend. Is the number actually going down?
The answer is yes, and also not really, depending on which number you track. Let's start with the good news. The number of people without basic access has fallen from 1.1 billion in the year 2000 to 703 million in 2024. That's a 36% reduction in absolute terms. And because the global population grew over that same period, the percentage of the world without basic access dropped from 18% to 8.6%. That's a genuine, substantial improvement.
On basic access, the world is winning. Slowly, but winning.
Now the safely managed story. The number of people with safely managed access has increased from 4.2 billion to 5.8 billion since 2015. That's 1.6 billion people gaining top-tier access in a decade. But the number of people lacking safely managed water has barely budged. 2.2 billion in 2015, 2.1 billion in 2024. 100 million person improvement over 9 years. The percentage dropped from 30% to 26%.
Why does the absolute number barely move when 1.6 billion people gained access?
Population growth in the countries with the lowest access levels ate the gains. Sub-Saharan Africa added roughly 300 million people during that period. Most of them were born into communities without safely managed water. So you're running just to stay in place. The tap is being installed, but the population is growing faster than the plumbing.
Running up the down escalator. And the SDG target?
The 2026 UN Progress Report on SDG 6 is sobering. At current rates, universal basic access will be achieved by 2043, which is 13 years late. For safely managed water, the target year is 2030, but the projected achievement date is 2055 at best. And that's if nothing goes wrong, no climate shocks, no funding collapses. The gap is widening for the poorest quintile. The people who need the most progress are seeing the least.
2055. A full quarter century after the target. So the SDG 6.1 goal is effectively dead. Not delayed, dead. Nobody's going to say that out loud at the UN, but the math doesn't lie.
The funding picture makes it worse. The World Bank's 2025 GLAAS report, that's the Global Analysis and Assessment of Sanitation and Drinking Water, found that countries with the lowest access levels spend the least per capita on water. Often under $5 per person per year. The estimated cost to meet SDG 6.1 is about $114 per person per year in rural areas. The funding gap is $114 billion annually, and only $26 billion is currently flowing.
The places that need the money most are spending $5 per person, and the target is $114. That's not a gap, that's a chasm. And I'm guessing the $26 billion that's flowing isn't all going to the places with the lowest access.
It's not. A lot of water funding is politically allocated, not need-based. Middle-income countries with functioning bureaucracies absorb a disproportionate share because they can write grant proposals and navigate World Bank procurement processes. The Central African Republic doesn't have a water ministry with 100 staffers who know how to apply for Green Climate Fund financing.
The administrative capacity to absorb aid is inversely correlated with the need for aid. That's the tragedy of a lot of development funding, not just water. It's like a food bank that only gives groceries to people who can fill out a 12-page application in triplicate. The people who are hungriest are the least equipped to navigate the bureaucracy. But water has an extra complication.
Groundwater depletion is the sleeper crisis. The 2025 NASA GRACEFOS satellite data showed the Indus Basin aquifer, which underlies India and Pakistan, losing 8 cubic kilometers of water per year. 8 cubic kilometers. That's a volume of water roughly the size of a small Great Lake, vanishing annually. As shallow wells dry up, rural communities fall back to surface water, rivers, ponds. That's a reversal. People who had improved access lose it because the aquifer beneath them is being mined faster than it recharges.
Surface water means waterborne disease, means women and children spending hours fetching water again. Climate doesn't just threaten future progress, it's actively reversing past gains.
The 2024 drought in the Horn of Africa pushed 12 million people back to unimproved sources. 12 million people in a single year. That's equivalent to wiping out a decade of access gains in that region. And these droughts are becoming more frequent. The IPCC's sixth assessment projected that what used to be a once-in-a-generation drought in East Africa will be a once-per-decade event by 2030.
The trend line isn't a smooth upward slope. It's a sawtooth. Gains during normal years, sharp reversals during drought years. And the droughts are accelerating. It's like trying to fill a bathtub while someone periodically pulls the drain plug.
Which brings me to the technology angle, because there's a seductive narrative that point-of-use treatment, chlorine tablets, ceramic filters, UV pens can bridge the remaining gap without needing to build massive infrastructure. And there's some truth to it. A 2023 Cochrane review, the gold standard for evidence synthesis in public health, found that household water treatment reduces diarrhea by 52% when used consistently.
When used consistently, that's doing a lot of work.
The adherence problem is the whole ballgame. The same Cochrane review found that consistent use drops to about 30% after 6 months. People start with good intentions, they use the chlorine tablets, they boil the water. 6 months in, the tablets run out, and the next batch isn't free, or the boiling fuel is needed for cooking instead, or the treated water tastes slightly different and family members complain. The last mile problem in water isn't technological, it's behavioral.
Like adopting a feral cat. The technology exists. The cat is right there. But consistent long-term engagement is the actual challenge.
That's a weirdly apt metaphor, and I want to push on it. With a feral cat, you're fighting against the animal's instincts and past experience. With water treatment, you're fighting against habit, convenience, and sometimes taste preferences. What's the behavioral economics equivalent of a can of tuna?
I think it's making the default option the safe option. If the water coming out of the tap is already treated, you don't have to remember to add chlorine tablets. The behavioral intervention isn't convincing people to do something. It's making the safe choice the path of least resistance. But that requires infrastructure, which brings us back to the funding problem.
Bangladesh's arsenic mitigation program is the canonical example of this gap between intervention and adoption. In the 1990s, Bangladesh discovered that millions of its tube wells, which had been drilled to solve the surface water disease problem, were contaminated with naturally occurring arsenic. A massive testing program ensued. 20 million wells tested, 1.5 million painted red as contaminated. The solution was to switch to green wells or use deeper aquifers. But a follow-up study found that 10 years later, 40% of red-tagged wells were still in use, because the nearest green well was too far away, or the deeper well water tasted different, or people simply didn't believe the test results.
20 million wells tested, an enormous logistical achievement. And a decade later, nearly half the contaminated wells are still being drunk from, because the alternative was inconvenient. That's not a failure of technology, or even of information. That's a failure of the behavioral and economic assumptions baked into the intervention. They assumed that if you tell people the water is poisoned, they'll walk an extra half mile to the safe well. But walking an extra half mile every day, carrying water, is a real cost. And if the poisoned water doesn't make you visibly sick today, the immediate cost of the walk outweighs the long-term risk of the arsenic.
It's a temporal discounting problem. The arsenic might give you cancer in 20 years. The walk to the green well costs you 30 minutes right now. Humans are terrible at trading off present costs against future risks, especially when the present cost is concrete and the future risk is probabilistic. And it's the same dynamic that makes maintenance such a critical leverage point. A 2025 World Bank study found that 30% of rural water systems in sub-Saharan Africa are non-functional within 5 years of installation. Not 30 years, 5 years. A hand pump breaks. The spare part isn't available locally. The village doesn't have the funds to send someone to the district capital to buy it, and the pump sits broken. Everyone goes back to the river.
The highest return on investment isn't drilling new boreholes. It's keeping the existing ones working.
The World Bank analysis explicitly says that spending on maintenance and local supply chains has a higher ROI than new construction. But maintenance is boring. Donors want to cut ribbons on new wells. There's no photo op for "We fixed the gasket on a pump installed in 2018. The incentive structure of development funding is biased toward construction over maintenance.
That's the governance problem. Nobody wants to fund the unglamorous work of keeping things running. It's the infrastructure equivalent of how news media covers plane crashes, but not the millions of flights that land safely. The drama is in the new thing, not in the thing that quietly works. Meanwhile, Cape Town almost ran out of water entirely.
Cape Town's Day Zero crisis in 2018 is a fascinating counterpoint to the infrastructure first narrative. The city was weeks away from turning off the taps, the first major city in the world to face that prospect. And they averted it not by building a desalination plant or drilling new boreholes, but through demand-side management. Water restrictions, public pressure campaigns, pressure reduction in the pipe network. Water demand dropped 50% in 3 years.
Behavioral change and pressure management. No new supply. Just using less of what they had. That's the demand-side story that gets overshadowed by the shiny infrastructure projects. And what's striking about Cape Town is that they didn't just nudge people with polite suggestions. They published a map of household water consumption by neighborhood. Public shaming as a water conservation tool. It was extraordinarily effective, and also deeply uncomfortable as a governance model.
The map was controversial, but it worked. People who were using more water than their neighbors got phone calls from the city. There was a hotline where you could report your neighbor for watering their lawn. It was a wartime mobilization mentality applied to municipal water. And contrast that with Singapore's Any Water System. Singapore took the opposite approach. Massive investment in membrane technology, reverse osmosis, UV disinfection, turning wastewater into drinking quality water. It works brilliantly for a wealthy city-state with a technocratic government and the ability to invest billions. But that model doesn't transfer to rural Ethiopia or the peri-urban slums of Dhaka. There's no one right answer. The solution has to match the governance capacity and the economic reality of the specific place.
We've got a measurement problem, a funding misalignment, a maintenance crisis, climate reversals, and a behavioral adoption gap. The actual number of people without clean water is somewhere between 700 million and 2.2 billion, depending on definitions. The trend is positive for basic access, barely moving for safely managed, and fragile everywhere. Where does that leave someone who encounters a water access statistic in their work or reading?
I'd say there are three questions to ask whenever you see a water access number. First, what tier of the JMP ladder does this refer to? Is it safely managed, basic, or something else? The difference between 2.2 billion and 700 million is entirely about which rung you're standing on. Second, was water quality tested or modeled? If a country doesn't have a national testing program, the number is an estimate built on assumptions. Treat it as directional, not precise. Third, is this point source or point of use? The borehole might be clean, but what's in the cup? Those three questions will tell you how much to trust the statistic.
That's a useful mental toolkit. And the corollary is that any number that doesn't specify the tier is probably useless. A headline that says, X million people lack water, without defining what lack water means, is noise, not signal.
The leverage point that I think is most underappreciated is maintenance. The 30% non-functionality rate in sub-Saharan Africa is a scandal hiding in plain sight. We've already paid for those systems. The concrete is poured, the pump is installed, and a third of them are broken within 5 years. Fixing what we already built is the highest impact, lowest cost intervention available, and it's systematically underfunded because it's not newsworthy.
It's the infrastructure equivalent of preventive medicine. Everyone agrees it's more cost-effective than emergency surgery, but the funding goes to the emergency room because that's where the drama is.
The climate piece makes this urgent in a way that didn't exist when the SDGs were drafted in 2015. The Indus Basin losing 8 cubic kilometers a year, the Horn of Africa drought pushing 12 million people back to surface water, these aren't projections. They're measurements from the last 2 years. The next decade is going to determine whether SDG 6.1 is merely delayed or completely abandoned. If we get a series of severe drought years in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, the trend lines could flatline or reverse.
Which brings us to the open question that I think defines the next era of water policy. The JMP is currently redesigning its monitoring framework for the post-2030 period. There's a debate about whether the safely managed metric should move from a binary classification, safe or unsafe, to something risk-based. a probability of contamination over time, accounting for seasonal variation, intermittency, and climate vulnerability. That would change the headline number dramatically, and probably make it larger.
Because a probabilistic metric captures what the binary metric hides. A water source that's clean in the dry season but contaminated during floods would show up as risky year-round, not as safe with occasional problems. It's a more honest representation of the lived experience of water insecurity, but it also makes the problem look worse, which is politically uncomfortable. Governments that are currently reporting steady progress would suddenly see their numbers drop, not because conditions changed, but because the ruler changed.
That political discomfort is precisely why the debate is happening now, years before the post-2030 framework takes effect. Nobody wants to be the minister who announces that water access in their country just fell by 15 percentage points because of a methodological change. The politics of measurement are as fraught as the measurement itself.
There's a technological dimension to this. Satellite-based water quality monitoring is becoming viable. NASA's ESO COSTRIS, the ESA Sentinel 2, they can detect algal blooms and sediment plumes from orbit. By 2030, we may have near real-time global water quality data that makes the current survey-based approach look as archaic as measuring poverty by asking people if they feel poor.
Which would be a revolution in accountability. Right now, a government can report that 80% of its population has safely managed water, and there's no independent way to verify that. Satellite monitoring changes the game. But it also raises privacy and sovereignty questions. Who gets to monitor whose water? And what happens when the satellite data contradicts the government's official statistics?
We saw a preview of this with air quality monitoring. When satellite data on PM2.5 pollution started contradicting official ground station numbers in various countries, it created a diplomatic friction that's still unresolved. Water is arguably more sensitive because it's not just about public health, it's about agricultural capacity and national security. A satellite that can detect groundwater depletion is also a satellite that can identify which countries are mining their aquifers unsustainably.
Which means the data exists, or will exist soon. But whether it gets incorporated into official statistics is a political question, not a technical one. The number of people without clean water is decreasing, but the rate of decrease is slowing. The easy progress, drilling wells in accessible areas, connecting urban households to existing piped networks, has largely been made. What remains is harder. It's about maintenance, governance, behavioral change, and climate resilience. The infrastructure that's already in the ground is decaying faster than it's being replaced. The aquifers that supply a third of the world's agriculture are depleting. And the funding system is structured to reward construction over everything else.
The 2.2 billion number is a useful rallying cry. It gets attention, it mobilizes resources, it makes the problem feel urgent. But as a policy tool, it's nearly useless. The 703 million without basic access, that's the number that tells you where to put pipes and pumps. The rest of the gap is about water safety, reliability, and behavior. Different problems, different solutions.
The next time someone drops a water access statistic on you, ask which rung of the ladder, whether the water was tested or modeled, and whether the measurement is at the source or at the lip of the cup. The answers will tell you more than the number ever could.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, the term flenser entered Arctic whaling parlance to describe the men who stripped blubber from whale carcasses on the shores of Nunavut. The word derives from a Danish verb meaning to slice into strips, and the job was considered so gruesome that flensers were paid in whiskey as well as wages.
Paid in whiskey to strip blubber in the Arctic. That's a compensation package.
I have so many follow-up questions that I'm going to suppress for the sake of the closing.
This has been My Weird Prompts, with thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com, and if you enjoyed this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. We'll be back with a new prompt next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.